Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Terry Allen and Joe Harvey Allen. I recorded an interview with them a couple of days ago about their upcoming performance, Ghost Ship Rodez. On Sunday, April 11th, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe is going to be hosting a special showing of the documentary films Voices from Inside, Israelis Speak, along with a short film called Reframing the Issue. And the producer, Marjorie Wright, and narrator, Hazel Kahn, will be introducing the movie and leading a question and answer following the films. We have with us now on the telephone, Hazel Kahn. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here talking to you.
So this film started out being about a one-state solution for Palestine and Israel, but that's not how the film ended up. What happened?
Well, a one-state solution is a very, this whole thing is very, very complicated, but a one-state solution implies there'll be one country, Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians, all living together in one country. Well, it's just not possible, and more people started to realize that demographically, it's not possible. Ideologically, it's not possible. And what that ends up doing is it puts the Palestinians into the minority, at least in the beginning. It would be a country run by Israel, run by the Jews, basically for themselves. But the problem is also that a two-state solution is becoming increasingly not possible, because the Israelis have, ever since 67, or really more recently since the first Intifada, they've taken up more and more of Palestinian land. So about something like 10-11% of the land that is actually Palestinian land has been annexed by Israel, with a wall carving up the territory. So what could have been the second country, the second state, the Palestinian state, is so unviable. There's nothing really there. And it's all divided up into little Bantu states, with the apartheid model of South Africa here being an appropriate comparison. So there's nothing there. There's no there. There's nothing for a country, enough land, contiguous land, to call itself a country. So frankly, whether it's one state or two state is almost impossible to judge now or to decide now. The issues are bigger than that. The issues really are human rights issues. And I think that's really what the focus of the film is, that people, that Israelis themselves are speaking out against the creation of a military state that is denying the Palestinians their rights and removing their land from them.
Somebody in the film, I think, called it something like the demilitarization of the minds of Israeli people.
That's a solution. That's what they would like to happen.
That's what they would like to happen.
Yes.
And that's what all the speakers in your film are, each one in a different way, trying to do.
That's right. And let's just talk in terms of the militarization so we can understand what demilitarization means.
Right.
The militarization of the Israeli people and of the land has been a steady drumbeat doing this. A report has just been issued. It's issued by the United Nations about children, by the United Nations, called Israel's Militarized State Education in Violation of Children's Rights. It's about the rights of children, the militarization of children, and it shows all the different ways in which militarization happens to children, starting obviously in school, and the romanticization of the soldier, and the ubiquity of soldiers with guns everywhere, and the attachment of romantic and commercial images. So you see, you know, a sweater being sold, and it's either got an Uzi on the thing itself, or you see a soldier holding it up. So when you see that it's actually happening at that level, from schools and from birth really onwards, and then the occupation itself, which necessitates the soldiers at the checkpoints, the checkpoints are really the nexus of so much of the bad stuff that goes on with the Israel Defense Forces. So there, and a lot of, well, I'll get back to that about this, a lot of soldiers refusing to serve in the West Bank, in the occupied territories. So at these check posts, you see the soldiers, who are these young men and women, you know, 18 to 21 or whatever. And then you see the Arab population is trying to get through so they can go to their homes or to their families or to their work. And they get there's a huge amount of abuse and violation and of human rights and brutality at these checkpoints. So one of the speakers, one of the interviewees, she talks about how can you be like this all during the day with your as a soldier? You don't leave that behind when you go home. You go home with your gun, with the experience of that week or that day of this brutalization of people much older than you, of children, whoever is an Arab. And you take it home, and this happens in homes all across Israel. So inevitably, this militarization and this mindset spreads so that the whole country is now, I would say, infected with it. They even attribute a very high increase in road rage and domestic violence to this militarization.
A couple of the speakers in the film are soldiers who served in the Israeli army and afterwards couldn't live with what they had done and are speaking out. So you have not only people who are refusing to serve in the first place, but people who did serve and then start talking about the horrible things that they basically had to do in their role as soldiers. What are these things? What are they doing to Palestinians?
Well, most Palestinians are not armed, first of all. They're not armed. You always see Palestinian children throwing stones, because that's what they've got. It's got the stones. I know Hamas or Hamas-related subgroups fire missiles at Sderot and some of the other places down southern Israel. But mostly, the brutalization really comes out of, or I don't know, cause or effect. They basically have dehumanized the Palestinian. They're not seen as having the same rights. They're not seen as having the same feelings. So that if a Palestinian woman is in birth, the last pangs of giving birth, they won't let her through in the car or the truck, whatever she's in, into a hospital. There was a film I just saw, for example, of a woman actually giving birth at the checkpoint, and the women, the other Palestinian women, just gathered around her to create a wall or a curtain so that she wouldn't be exposed to the rest of the world. It's pushing people around with the butt of the gun or with angry voices, intimidating them, threatening them. All they want to do is to sell their vegetables, or they want to go to the hospital, or they want to go to school, or it's a holiday and they want to go and visit their families. So it's the intimidation and the really brutalization of these people in combat gear. The contrast, the visual contrast, just tells the whole story. The Arab people with their white flowing clothes and baskets on their heads, and these Israelis in their uniforms. This film, I want to point out, this film was made before Gaza.
Right.
So if you made it today, you would have all of that experience of what the Israelis did in Gaza and all the brutalization and the murderous, the white phosphorus and all these things that they did. That's not even in this film.
But there are still reports, for example, of a soldier who fired machine guns into neighborhoods, not knowing who he was going to be hitting, but knowing he was going to be hitting and killing people.
Right. So it's this idea that they don't really count. You know, they're Palestinian. They don't call them Palestinians. They call them Arabs. They don't really count. And to me personally, I know it sounds odd, but I am most passionate about all of the olive trees, partly because I'm an artist too, and I do work with leaves and olive leaves and so on. But the brutalization of the way the Israelis have uprooted, not only uprooted these olive trees, which is one of the primary source of livelihood for the Palestinian farmers. There are photographs available of just decimated, just amputated trees, or trees actually just uprooted, and you see, you know, bulldozers and stuff hoisting them into the air. And some of these trees, then they take to the settlements and they plant them there. Or for those farmers who still have access to their own olive groves, there are so many photographs available of the soldiers standing around while the Arab people are shaking the trees, the men, usually the women, shaking the trees to get the olives, which is how they harvest them. And they're standing there with their guns pointed and intimidating them. To do that, because Israel started out, you know, before Israel, but then the Jews came over from Europe and so on, one of the things they were going to do is they were agricultural. They were going to make the desert green. They were going to plant and sow and till the soil. And the kibbutzim, a lot of the kibbutzim were, after all, agricultural enclave businesses, ventures. So it seems to me a manifestation of this brutalization and the militarization of the Israeli mind, that they can destroy crops and farms, feel this way about farmers, that it doesn't matter, that because they're Arab farmers, they don't feel this. And you have pictures of Arab farmers crying. For them, it's like losing a child, they say.
And that, in the name of, quote-unquote, redeeming the land, I mean, one of the things that's so painful about this situation, which is so clearly shown in the film, is that the founding of Israel had so much hope and vision for a good and secure life after the Holocaust. And this film really cracks open that myth and shows the many ways in which Israel is not living up to its promise, or is living up to its promise on the backs of real people. And I mean, apparently some Israelis don't even understand that there's an occupation in the first place.
Yeah. No, that's, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Israel because my parents both died there. I mean, we came late in life to Israel, but so I visited them very often. And it's really, the Israelis, they don't want to talk about it. And you can be an Israeli and drive around Israel, and you can never see a Palestinian. And there's the wall, and we haven't talked about the wall, but the wall is not only a barrier to suicide, people who come and who are intent on killing themselves in order to kill Israelis. That has, of course, been now much, much reduced in intensity, because the wall works. It's very difficult to get through the wall. It's 26 foot high. And it snakes all over the country. But the point is that you can just never even see the wall. So it's a metaphorical wall, too. It allows Israelis to be just only looking with blinders. So they don't know about the occupation. And some of the people in the film said they were adults before they'd even met a Palestinian. And so it's very difficult to penetrate the Israeli mind. It's a national circling the wagons, so they don't want to know these things. I think that there is a lot of access to things on the internet, or even Haaretz, for instance, one of the leading Israeli newspapers, does have a few very, very important and courageous journalists who speak about these things. One of them is Amira Haas. She actually lived in Ramallah and in Gaza. And there's Gideon Levy. There are really good journalists who write about these things. But basically, I have, frankly, in my own life, I mean, I've known a lot of Israelis. I don't have contact with them anymore because it's impossible to email them or to talk to them on the phone. You can't get through to them, because as soon as you criticize Israel, they become defensive. Some of them might be left-wing people, you know, and they might actually be activists, but they can only criticize Israel from the inside. But the you talked about the soldiers and the breaking the silence and so on. There's also these very young ones, the Shministim, who are 12th graders. And that's a big growing movement of these 12th graders, people who haven't even entered the army yet, who are saying that who are conscientious objectors. And some of them have been imprisoned for maybe for 10 days, 2 weeks.
Watching this film, the speakers that you have, the people whom you interviewed and who are Israeli and who are talking about this situation from inside Israel, all of whom are in different ways part of a peace movement and part of a movement to raise the consciousness of other Israelis to let them see what's going on. That's an intergenerational movement. I mean, there are teenagers to much older people and everyone in between.
That's right. It's intergenerational, but on the other hand, in the last, I don't know whether it's just a few months, maybe, or since the Goldstone report came out in September, the Israelis have become extremely repressive about these inside voices. The Shministim is just one example, but there are other ones. NGOs or human rights, international human rights organizations, their computers have been seized. You know, their hard drives are ripped out, all sorts of things like this. There's a tremendous amount of repression now.
It's amazing that even for you, the child of Holocaust survivors, Jewish, living outside of Israel even you are not listened to and you are shut out.
No, they wouldn't listen to me. Half of Israel is children of Holocaust survivors, after all. You know, I have no particular legitimacy within Israel. The Israelis just do circle the wagons very quickly, and you lose credibility if you weren't born in Israel, you know, or if you're... And it's also increasingly a religious rather than a secular society, so that the rabbis are having more and more power with the army. I mean, there is more and more of a growing partnership between the rabbis and the army, because the expansion and the seizing of land and so on, and through the settlements, and many of these settlements are highly right-wing religious organizations that believe that it's all the greater Israel, the land of Israel. They don't call it the West Bank. They call it Judea and Samaria. So it becomes a religious duty to settle the land as it was in the Bible, or as God gave it to us, as they would say. I am very much in support of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement that's an international movement, and that the Palestinians themselves asked the international community to start. So there are many, many Israeli companies that are being boycotted, and there are many American companies, including people like Motorola, who've been very, from the Israeli point of view, too supportive of Israel and too much involved in supporting the Israel Defense Forces and so on.
We're talking to Hazel Khan. She is the narrator of the film Voices from Inside, Israelis Speak. The irony that is so obvious that it doesn't need to be said, but it does need to be said, is that the tactics are so much like what the Nazis did to the Jews.
You know, every time I hear that or think it, I get chills down my spine. I don't know what to do with that thought, you know, but it's clear. It's clear. And, you know, there's no doubt, and we cannot take away the Holocaust, but we cannot also use it as an excuse or as a justification. The Holocaust happened. The Jews were murdered. It stays in your blood. Even though, frankly, half of the Israeli citizens are not European in origin. They come from other countries. They did not endure the Holocaust. But it's already third, fourth generation now. But you cannot treat another nation badly. They had nothing to do with the Holocaust. So that's one incredibly deep deception, flaw, myth. But the other thing is, you know, I don't know what to do. I mean, did the Jews then just imitate their oppressors? Or is this what traumatized people do? They either model themselves on those who oppress them, or they become completely the opposite and say, "Never, I would never, ever allow another human being to experience what I experience." The Rabbi Milgram, I think it was, who says in the film, "Never again," but never again for everybody, not just never again for the Jews. I don't know. I don't know what the explanation is, but the idea that something is terribly wrong with this country, and it can be expressed in psychological, psychiatric terms.
Yeah, I've heard Israel called a nation with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm. But that's true of Iraq, too. And so when they have more violence on the streets of Iraq, which is what's happening today, and yesterday, or Pakistan, but we don't forgive them for it, right? We call them into account even if they have post-traumatic stress. But in Israel, it's institutionalized.
Well, something that's happening that's interesting is on this program, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, I interview people who are coming through town and presenting movies, presenting lectures, and so on. And in the last year, there have been a whole number of people like you, like Ziad Abbas, and so on, talking about this situation. And it seems like there is a real wave in the United States of both Jewish and non-Jewish people really bringing this issue to light in a way that has not been done before. I suppose Gaza is part of the reason for that.
I think so. I think Gaza really was a tipping point. And then even over Christmas, New Year, when they were trying to bring things into Gaza, the Freedom March into Gaza, and trying to get the ships to bring supplies to Gaza because the Israelis wouldn't let any materials through, I think it suddenly accelerated. I think all the dots started being connected in America. I mean, in Europe, this is been an old story already, but here in America it's definitely started, because suddenly it's become acceptable to criticize Israel. That doesn't mean, however, that AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, isn't extremely powerful, but I think they are becoming anxious. There are more and more threads of this dissent, of daring to speak out. The genie can't be put back into the bottle again, I think. About a month ago in New York City, I was in this march. To me, it was unprecedented. It was in Midtown Manhattan on a weekday, just when all the office workers were coming out of the offices. They saw us marching completely quietly with everybody's wearing black. The protest, it was going around the whole block where the Waldorf Astoria is, and inside there was a fundraising for the Israel Defense Forces. To me, I mean, I couldn't even wrap my head around it. How do Americans have a private fundraising for another country's army? But in the end, it turns out they raised $20 million that night.
Oh, my Lord.
But to me, when I think it made a big impression. So things like that, I think it's incremental. Each of these things connects with another thing like that, and it becomes more and more of a movement. Jews, in particular, who are speaking out, who are daring to say there's something, not even an elephant in the room, there's a monster in the room. But it's a painful thing for Jews to loosen themselves from the grip of this Zionist thing that they grew up with. It's a very difficult thing to manage what is essentially a divided loyalty. That's what Marjorie is hoping the next film that we're planning will be, to interview American Jews on that subject.
Oh, very interesting. I mean, as I was watching and I thought, oppression is such a cliche. It looks the same everywhere. We could do a film about the American version of colonialism in many different forms. And the thing that is so hard to understand is how hard it is to drop it. I mean, we ended slavery here, but then there was Jim Crow, and then there was the 50s and the 60s, and there are still people who hate Obama because he's black. And we get over it, and then the next generation does yet a new thing. In your film, the people whom you interviewed, their point of view is we really actually can all live with each other. It doesn't have to be
That's right. That's right. I think my own particular thing is not just being the child. My parents, you know, were Holocaust survivors, but I'm Jewish. And I'm a secular Jew. I'm not a religious person at all. But I was brought up with Jewish values. And Jews are not supposed to do these things. You're supposed to welcome the stranger. You're supposed to extend hospitality. You're supposed to share. You're not supposed to steal. My personal motivation and the thing that inflames and I hope directs me in some rational way, is that I feel that I have to speak out, because Israel's speaking in my name. It's saying Jews had the Holocaust, so we have to make sure we never get extinguished. Well, if you're going to speak in my name, then I get to speak in my name too against you. And I think a lot of people do feel this way. You know, Marjorie wanted this film to be one of the target audiences was American Jews, because it's doubtful that this film would ever be shown in Israel. The second audience is the Christian Zionists. And the third one is the Muslims, the Arabs. To show them that you shouldn't tar everybody with the same brush. Here are, is not only Jews, but Israeli Jews. And look, they are extending their hand. And the film has been shown in Egypt and in other places where there would be an Arab or Muslim audience. So I don't know. I guess it's inherent in human nature that we need to destroy other people. I don't know.
Hazel Khan is narrator of the film Voices from Inside, Israelis Speak, which is being shown this coming Sunday, the 11th of April, at the Center for Contemporary Arts. And she and the producer of the film, Marjorie Wright, will be there doing question and answer after the film. And the film, along with a short film called Reframing the Issue, the two films will also be shown the night before, Saturday, the 10th of April, at 7 o'clock at Woodward Hall, which is on the University of New Mexico campus. Hazel Khan, thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
I'm very happy to have been here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do they dream of hell in heaven? Are they restless with their reward? Does God spend time with his angels, or does he show them no regard?
He landed in Veracruz. The beauty made his teeth grind. He took the first train to Mexico City. He arrived destitute, but this prestigious friend from Paris had secured a lecture for him at the Children's Teatro. His subject was the idiocy of communism and genitalia. He thought it went very well. He used the lecture money to buy blank paper and codeine. Later, he fell down and he couldn't get up. Mon Dieu, he cried, but he couldn't get up. A teenage passerby kicked him in the face. He woke up filthy in this infirmary. On the street outside, a violin was playing.
We're talking about Antonin Artaud, and we're here with Terry Allen, artist and songwriter, and Joe Harvey Allen, who are doing a production which opens this Friday night at the Lensic in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Sharma.
So Antonin Artaud is the subject of the verses that you just read, and is the character about whom you, the real life character about whom you have crafted this piece that's at the Lensic. Who was he?
He lived in the 30s. He was, he died in 1948, but he was a very prominent French artist and kind of visionary theater person in the 30s and 40s, and influenced a lot of people like Patti Smith, Sam Shepard, the Living Theater, Peter Brook. Had a huge impact, I think, on the idea of what theater was, what art is. I first encountered him in a book in San Francisco in the early 60s. There was a book just called Artaud Anthology, and it was one of the first books where Artaud's writings were available in English. There was a series of photographs of his face in this book, and I'd never heard of the guy. I didn't know French or anything. I was in art school at the time, but these images of this guy's face had such a huge impact on me that I got the book. Then I began reading the writings and poems and things that he did, and over the years I was just very interested in his ideas. And I think he was one of those people that, because he was a drug addict, he was seriously mentally ill. He had numerous psychological and physical problems. But probably more than any artist that I've ever read about or heard about, he took those ailments and used them productively and made these incredible things out of it. The piece that we're doing, Ghost Ship Rodez, is about an incident that happened in his life. He had gone to Ireland, found this stick, and took it back to France with him, and had kind of convinced himself it was a staff of St. George. And
also Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And before that, Jesus Christ.
He went back and forth.
Then he took this kind of momentous trip to Mexico. He had had a theater in France that had been a terrible failure, called the Theater of Alfred Jarry. And he put on all of these productions that were not successful at all. And so, very depressed, he decided he would go to Mexico and kind of refurbish himself by take the peyote ceremonies with the Tarahumara. So he was in Mexico 6 months. And when he returned to France, he decided he should take this staff back to the Irish people and give it to them. So he took the staff back to Ireland, got into a big altercation with the cops, hit a cop on the head in Dublin with the staff. They confiscated it, threw him in jail, and and deported him and put him on a ship called the Washington. And he caused so much trouble on the ship that they straitjacketed him and chained him to a cot. And he was in that ship for 17 days in the dark.
That's a kind of a version of hell.
Yeah. And that's really, it's that 17 days that is the impetus for this piece, what might have happened in his head during that time. Rodez is a mental institution, one of the many that he was in after he arrived back in France. He was never out of institutions again. He had over 50 electric shock treatments in Rodez. But also, it was a period, one of his very most productive periods. He started drawing, he started writing again.
Well, the electroshock is so controversial, but I was reading somewhere about him that he actually became more productive after they started the electric shock.
Yeah, he did, which is pretty amazing. Seems to me like the last thing you'd want to do is be productive when you're fried.
He was a huge influence. I mean, to be such a failure in his own, he was really an outcast. The surrealist, he was always fighting them. Everybody was mad at him. No one would, you know, he had a radio show. They took it off the air. Everything he did was pretty much a failure, but he had such an impact. His ideas, and he was brilliant, really, and it influenced so many artists and actors and writers. And I was 35 when I wrote my first play, and Terry gave me Theater and Its Double, his book. And the thing I remember most was that it really forced you or inspired you to be more courageous and to approach work in a different way. And there was a breakdown scene I did in this play. And after reading that book, I would experiment with things. I would go, well, what does the dog think about listening to Murat Said loud in the living room? And I would be crawling around on the floor. What does it feel like to be crawling in the bushes naked like an animal outside listening to this or that? And that's how I actually got the breakdown scene in the first play, but it pushed boundaries for me. And I think that's what he did for a lot of people.
Well, he had a theater he called the Theater of Cruelty. And it wasn't really about sadism overtly, but it was about challenging habits and taking everything, whether it was your voice, your body, your religion, whatever it was, taking it as far as you possibly could beyond your habits. He despised drawing room drama. He thought that theater should be like a visceral experience for the viewer, for the actor, for everybody involved. So his whole focus was on challenging the things that you think are normal and the things that you would consider habits. He was one of those people. He was a child of kind of a secondary incest. His two grandmothers were sisters, so his mother and dad were first cousins. Because of this, he had meningitis when he was very young. Because of that, he had headaches, horrible headaches his entire life, which kind of brought about his drug abuse. It wasn't so much recreational drug abuse as it was really kind of battling pain, and he was constantly trying to detox. But he had a number of mental kind of maladies. One of the things that he thought was that his brain could not think. And he wrote these incredible, thoughtful letters about how he couldn't think. And it was constantly pointed out to him by psychiatrists and by friends or whatever, but look how thoughtful this is, you know.
He was haunted by these horrific demons. And all the women in his life that haunted him, that were fabrications in his mind, he called the daughters of the heart to be born. And in the play, I am the daughters of the heart to be born. So I am a combination of the bitch, the clairvoyant, the mother, the lover, these various women. And I also tried to become the voice of Artaud as we imagined maybe his way of surviving this horrific ordeal when he's like chained to this cot in the hull of this ship, the Washington. And an interesting thing happened in our own life while Terry was writing this piece, that we actually went to the places, and it had nothing, just coincidental, but we went to Ireland, to Mexico, where the Tahamara are, and we also went to France. So we were in these places that the play, the locations of that take place of this period of time in his life where he was. So a lot of the writing was influenced by that, and it's interesting for me because there are things that when Terry gave me the script, I knew exactly where they were written and
right.
what they were, because I'd been in that beautiful garden that he was thinking about in the hull of this ship to free his mind.
We're talking to Terry Allen and Joe Harvey Allen about the performance coming up at the Lensic this weekend, Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock, called Ghost Ship Rodez. And you also have an installation at Site Santa Fe
yeah.
as part of their one-on-one exhibition, which has videos and installations and all sorts of things. And this is all about the exact same material, this Artaud material, and includes video installation and art and a lot of text. Is it similar? Is it some of the same text that you use in the play?
Well, I think of the piece, Ghost Ship Rodez, as two parts. One is at the exhibition, which is at Site Santa Fe, and the other is the theater piece, which is at the Lensic. So combining the two together is the single piece.
Right.
Most of the work at Site Santa Fe focuses on the Mexican trip that we were talking about when he was that. There's like five chronicles called the Momo Chronicles, and Artaud called himself Le Momo.
What does that mean?
It means kind of a charmed idiot. It's comes from voodoo, I think, actually, somewhere in the Caribbean. But he called himself this kind of lunatic, which was echoed when he went to the Tarahumara Indians. They were extremely afraid of him. They called him El Brujo, the witch man.
They thought he could predict the end of the world, and yeah. he knew when people were going to die, and they were really frightened of him.
And, I mean, you figure this crazy Frenchman goes out and lives in extreme squalor in the middle of the desert with these Indians. You can imagine kind of what they thought of him, and no language connection whatsoever. Just only this desire to do peyote with him.
It's funny that he didn't learn the languages of the places he went. I mean, apparently part of his problem in Ireland was they had no idea what he was trying to say.
Yeah.
He didn't learn a word of English.
Yeah, and he didn't know Spanish. He did know, toward the end of his life, a little bit of English, I think. But, again, I think that kind of addresses that thing. He thought not just theater, but life was beyond language. So language was just one of those things, another thing you had to transcend. You know?
He was so powerful, that idea that he had that theater, everything went beyond what you thought it was. And he is such a powerful spirit that working on this play, I was like, I think a lot of people in France, I really wanted to shun it at first because I was very afraid of his vulgarity. You know, sometimes I do comedy, and this was, you know, it was difficult to play these demons that haunted him and play him. But I grew over the whole process. We did the play first in France, and then we took it to Massmocha, and now finally here. And during that whole process, I grew so fond of him. I actually have a very gentle, loving feeling. And it enabled me, I think, to be free to really play the demons better that haunted him.
Yeah, I was looking at how he lived. I thought, I would not have wanted to know this man.
Right.
But knowing him through his work is a different thing.
It's very different. And his spirit, a lot of strange things have happened in the process of doing this play. So I very much feel his presence.
What kind of strange things?
Well, And now this is very crazy to people who might think it's crazy, but when we were working in France and I was having a difficult time even memorizing the play, I wasn't doing very well at it. And only I saw it, but behind the stage, we had a big staff that was part of the play, and it moved about 4 feet. And I saw it, and I just went, oh, my God. I better pay attention here.
The ghost of Artaud is the here ghost, moving my
It's
staff.
Either the ghost of Artaud, it's the staff of St. George, or the staff of Jesus. Well, I really don't know about the staff of St. George. So I immediately had this conversation with Artaud in my mind, and I really made peace with the peace. And I vowed to try to bring the best. I guess it's kind of like a redemptive good feeling about Artaud because he suffered so much, and we're so afraid of people that are different than us. And we just want to not hear their vulgarity or not pay attention to them. And he had so much to give to be so damaged.
There's a sentence in the exhibition at Site Santa Fe, do they dream of hell in heaven?
Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Well, I mean, it's the idea of, like, the verse is, do they dream of hell in heaven? Are they restless with their reward? Does God spend time with his angels, or does he show them no regard? It's kind of addresses the idea of boredom, I think, eternal boredom. And
like eternal bliss would be boring?
I think Mark Twain talked about, you know, he couldn't think of anything worse than being eternally sitting on a cloud with a bunch of people trying to learn how to play a harp, you know, forever. And so it's just that switch from, rather than do they dream of heaven in hell, do they dream of hell in heaven? And it's also, I think it refers to back to life, you know. Do people miss their life? Do they miss things about being alive and not just being some kind of splendor? And it works with Artaud, I think, because he was, in a sense, always in a state of being subjected to heaven. And so he was kind of constantly rebelling against that which is perfection, or that which is the norm or the exception.
Have you ever met someone that, and I have, that one day they're an atheist and the other day they're like a religious fanatic? It goes back and forth, and I kind of have this feeling that he was grappling with all of that all the time in his mind. So in this piece, he talks a lot about beauty and angels, and that's with all the other haunting, vulgar things that were happening to him as well.
What was his theater like, this so-called surrealist theater?
It looked pretty, from the photographs I could tell, it looked pretty traditional. You know, kind of costume dramas. And he did one called The Cenci, which was a big flop. But it was about an emperor who was heavy into incest and into murder. And Artaud, kind of the way he thought stage directions were ever bit as important, if not more important, than the speeches or the dialogue. So his writing about directions is actually almost more interesting than the actual text. But I don't think it ever, people were just kind of, I think, just mystified by why anybody would do that, except for people like André Breton, a number of surrealists, a number of artists and writers of that period of time. They always supported him. They knew that there was something so unique in his life, in his mind. So he always had this kind of support group, even though a lot of time he would lash out against it. Like these daughters of the heart to be born, he would write spells, terrible spells, and hope that they died. and he would burn cigarette, you know, burn holes in them and tear them and defecate on them and then mail them. And then he'd start feeling weird about it or bad about it, and so he would write a protection spell and to try to cancel out that spell.
Good heavens.
But all of these people kind of went along with, you know, his quirks. His last piece was called To Have Done With the Judgment of God, which was a radio show, and it was banned after the first performance and really just released about 2 or 3 years ago, reissued. But he worked with a number of, like a guy like Roger Blinn, who was one of the first people at the time to work with Beckett. So he always had this kind of support system of artists, you know, when things were really bleak for him.
How did this piece come about in the first place?
We were doing a play, a piece called War Boy, which is a part of a body of work I did called Dugout in Houston. And there's a group in Houston called the Houston French Alliance. And so the French Council happened to see this piece and came back after the and liked it and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a new piece in France, in Lyon, a year from then, at this place called La Subsistance, which was like a big laboratory for artists, performing artists, circus people, musicians, all the performing arts. So I'd always been interested in Artaud, and I thought this gave me a chance to kind of really start and reinvestigate him and think about and maybe build a piece out of it.
The interesting thing, I think, that happened as a result of doing that in France, we did it in English, and we thought it would be just a bust because of that, for one thing. But the French loved this piece, and the Paris newspaper said, can you believe that Artaud has been delivered, returned to us through Bush country? Because it was such a hotbed of political times with Bush being in office.
Yeah, the Freedom of Rice thing.
Like, yeah.
You know, that, and pouring wine in the streets. You remember when there was all that issue with France?
Yeah. Haven't we gotten over that level of...
Well, that was right in the middle of it at that time. Yeah. And one of the things that did concern us was like doing this performance, which we were really building and performed it in progress at the time, was the language. We don't know French, and the piece wasn't in French, and we were doing it for a completely French audience. And so they were concerned about it too, because the French notoriously kind of were kind of impatient with theater stuff and would walk out. And so they invited this actor, an American who'd been over the expatriate for like 30 years over there, who came, and we did a special performance for this guy. He really liked the piece. And so every performance, he met with the entire audience for about 30 minutes before and gave them little key things that were happening in the piece, so the structure of the piece, the songs. And I don't know what he said to him or how valuable it was to him, but we got a really good response.
It was, you know, funny because, you know, here we're using all these obscenities and everything in the play, and the French were crying at the end of this play and saying, it was so sweet. It was so sweet, which was shocking to us. But it really, I was so happy because I think that idea came across of really honoring him.
And the but love that you
and
have.
And the love that we both have for him and respect. But in doing all this horrible, you know, it ended up that they felt that it was sweet. And I was so happy about that.
Well, also the piece is really not profane. It challenges, I think, the idea of what God is to people. It challenges sex. It challenges the two together. It challenges what you think and what you, again, your habits of thinking about these things. So it's not, I think it's threatening in the sense of like that. It you know, it points a big finger and says, well, where are you with wherever you are?
It also, I think it addresses some of the things about the time that we're living in and this obsession with greed, gluttony, and me, me, me. one of the demons actually takes him into the village of Me, which is really a place where he falls into this abyss of me, myself, which is a dark, horrible place we all fall into when we become so self-obsessed. And in that, the people who live in this village are called mimes. The village has a billboard that says, me, mine, mine, all mine. It's a village with no deceptions. Every mine in me wants more. The minds in me walk around and they point at what they want with a finger on one hand and they point at themselves with a finger on the other. But mostly, though, the minds in me only want themselves. When he was led to this village, he was so excited.
Then Joe Harvey does his sermon, The God of Shit.
And it's really about worshiping yourself.
Yeah. And stuff.
And stuff.
Very interesting.
You know, I wanted to say something in the play, and that is that there is a lot of original music and musicians in the play. So it is a musical theater piece.
Music composed by you, Terry Allen.
Yeah.
And it's not like the music we heard right at the beginning of the show.
That song's in it, but not in that form. Yeah.
Well, people will just have to go see it at the Lensic this Friday and Saturday night, April 9th and 10th at 8 o'clock, Terry Allen and Joe Harvey Allen. Joe Harvey Allen stars in The Ghost Ship Rodez. And you can call the Lensic at 988-1234 or go to lensic.org. And also, the other part of this is the installation at Site Santa Fe. And that is going on through the 9th of May. They are at sitesantafe.org. Joe Harvey Allen and Terry Allen, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh. You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.